My name is Jenny, and I am with Sacramento Prisoner Support in Sacramento, California.
And tell us what Sacramento Prisoner Support does.
Sacramento Prisoner Support has been around since about 2004, which was actually before I got here. Much, although certainly not all, of the work that the group has been engaged in has focused mostly on pretrial support for people who have been facing federal charges, mostly for environmental actions. Probably the most well-known case that we have been involved in is the case of Eric McDavid.
And can you tell us about Eric McDavid's case?
Sure. Eric was arrested in January of 2006, along with Zach Simpson and Lauren Wiener. All three of those folks were charged with a single count of conspiracy to destroy by arson or explosives public and private property. No actions were ever actually carried out, which is why so many people very correctly identify Eric's case as a very poignant example of the government successfully prosecuting a thought crime. A thought crime which was, by the way, completely created by a paid government informant who spent over a year and a half drawing in Eric and his co-defendants and ultimately entrapping them.
So her name was Anna. Can you tell us about her, please?
Sure. Anna was about 17, and she started working for the feds. The story about how she became involved with them is sort of interesting. She was taking a class. This all came out during her testimony at Eric's trial. She was taking a class at a community college in Florida and decided that she was going to go, as she said, undercover to investigate the FDA protests in Miami that were happening at the time, and then write a paper about it, which is what she did. And apparently there was a cop in the class who thought her paper was great. He took it to his superiors, who were also pretty into it, and she got a phone call the next day, and soon after she was working for the feds in an official paid capacity. After that point in time, she went to various gatherings and protests. For the next 2 years, actually, she went to all sorts of different things, including Crime Think gatherings and Feral Vision. She went to the RNC in New York and a few other things. And she actually met Eric and Zach at a Crime Think gathering in August of 2004. And she pretty quickly attached herself to Eric specifically. At trial, she testified that she thought he was safe and gentle, which is why she chose him to befriend. And at the time, she actually reported back to her handlers at the FBI that he was not a person of interest. Of course, he became a person of interest after she repeatedly sought him out, created this crime, the so-called crime of conspiracy, and then entrapped him in it. And, you know, the other interesting thing about Anna is that when Eric and Zach and Lauren were all arrested, their entire existence was basically funded by her and the FBI. She was driving the car that they traveled in. She was paying for the house that they were staying in. She supplied the computers they were using, bought the food they ate. In fact, the three of them would not really have been on the same coast if Anna hadn't brought them all there to be together. She was kind of the glue that made them stick, and that glue had a pretty tenuous hold. The night before they were arrested, the group got into this huge argument, mostly because Anna, as she very often did, was pushing people really hard to set goals and follow through with them, which everybody else was pretty loath to do, and Anna kind of stormed out of the house. And I think it really seemed pretty clear to anybody who watched the surveillance footage from that night that the so-called conspiracy was really anything but. And that particular incident brought into question the timing of their arrest. Obviously, nothing was happening with these folks, but, you know, the feds had spent a lot of time and money on this case and needed an arrest, and so they swooped in and arrested everybody the next day.
That sounds very familiar, like what they've done to a lot of young Muslim men in the United States since 9/11.
That's correct. In fact, I remember a few months ago, every time I got online, I was sort of horrified. It seemed like there was a new case happening every week almost, you know, of, like you said, young Muslim men being entrapped in very much the same fashion. And, you know, what we had sort of been afraid of all along was that Eric's case would sort of be used as a model in the future for similar things, and it seems like that is actually what has happened. You know, they were pretty successful in prosecuting him, and even though it was this really outrageous example of a very clear-cut entrapment, they prosecuted it successfully, and so they've been able to move forward with similar prosecutions.
What happened with his co-defendants?
So Zach and Lauren both flipped and took a deal and started cooperating with the government. Lauren flipped much sooner than Zach did. We found out eventually that she had started cooperating, I think, within about a week of their arrest. And Zach took much longer. It took him about 6 months to sign a plea agreement. And ultimately what that meant for both of them was that they agreed to cooperate with the government in any and all investigations at that point in time or in the future that the government deemed them useful in. So that would include things like testifying against Eric at trial, which they both did. But also, you know, answering any sort of questions in debriefs with the FBI, testifying at grand juries, et cetera. And we're not entirely certain exactly which of those things they participated in, although we do know from things that happened at their sentencing that Lauren in particular was incredibly helpful with the feds in a number of other cases. Her lawyer was sort of expounding upon that at her sentencing, trying to get her a lower sentence, and, you know, said that she had helped them out, not only in Eric's case, but also in cases, unrelated cases in New York. So we're not entirely certain of the extent of their cooperation, but it seems like it was pretty helpful to the feds. And because of their cooperation, both Zach and Lauren got drastically reduced sentencing. Eric's sentence ended up being 19 years and 7 months, which is pretty outrageous, especially when you think about the fact that, you know, no crime was ever really committed here. This was just a conspiracy, supposed conspiracy, so no actions were ever carried out. But Zach and Lauren basically got time served. So for Lauren, she served about 2 or 3 weeks in jail before she got out on bail, and for Zach, it was about 6 months. So when you look at that, in light of the sentence that Eric got, it's pretty clear that there was some sentencing disparity issues happening in Eric's case.
So they essentially had a house with these 4 people in it getting paid for by the FBI to set these people up?
Yeah, that's correct. And that was sort of the culmination of a year and a half of, you know, pretty hard work on Anna's part. She was paid over $65,000 for her participation in this case. And, you know, they were only in that cabin for about a week before they got arrested. The rest of that year and a half was spent with Anna kind of following Eric around. Whenever they lost touch, she would email other people asking them if they knew where he was. She was very clearly seeking him out. And, you know, based on testimony and based on recorded conversations between Anna and Lauren and Zach, it was very clear that Anna was really the driving force with these folks. And there was a conversation recorded between Anna and Lauren specifically in which, you know, Anna was really identified as the person that radicalized, as they said, radicalized Eric. And so, you know, again, it's really clear that this was a case of entrapment, and, you know, it took a year and a half for Anna to get all of these folks, like I said, to the same coast. She had to drive Zach and Lauren across the country. Zach and Lauren were both on the East Coast, and she had to drive them across the country in her own car to get them out to California to meet Eric and to start living in this cabin together.
So can you tell us the arguments for the prosecution and the defense during the court?
Sure. So, you know, it was this very clear-cut case of entrapment, and so that was the defense that Eric used throughout trial. There was this sort of last-ditch effort by the government right before trial to try to get the judge to throw that out and to say that Eric could not use entrapment as a defense. Fortunately, I think this was probably the one single good ruling that the judge made throughout the entire case, but he did allow Eric to use the entrapment defense. He said there was very slight evidence that entrapment could have happened, so he let us move forward with that defense. And, you know, I think actually that particular incident speaks volumes about how the whole system really works. You know, Eric had spent a couple of years with his lawyer really building this entrapment defense, and that was what everything was based on. But if the judge had ruled in the government's favor right before trial about that particular issue, all of that work would have been lost. So anyway, a lot of the argumentation that was made by Eric and his lawyer was based on entrapment. And, you know, basically to prove entrapment, you have to prove that a person, well, the government has to prove that a person was predisposed to commit a crime before contact with a government agent. So I hope this doesn't get too confusing and weird. But basically what happened was the government convinced the judge to redefine what predisposition meant. And, you know, it sort of all hinged on when first contact with the government agent was, which obviously in this case was Anna. She was the government agent. And Eric met Anna in August of 2004. The government was trying to claim that instead of identifying that as first contact with the government agent, that the jury should instead look at first contact as being when Eric and Anna first discussed the crime, the alleged crime. But the thing is, in a conspiracy case, there is no crime, right? The crime is talking about the crime. So if you identify first contact as the time when they first start talking about the crime, you're saying that first contact started when the crime started. So obviously, if predisposition is supposed to happen before that, it creates a huge complication for the jury in figuring out, you know, this timeline and what kind of evidence they can look at. And so ultimately, the judge ended up deciding that the government's definition of predisposition was correct. And there was a lot of argumentation about that outside of the eyes of the jury. And so when the jury came back with questions during their deliberation process about Anna and when she became a government agent, the judge gave them a response in open court and told them not to write it down because he was going to issue a written response when they returned to the jury room. So they asked him, you know, was Anna a government agent in August of 04? He said yes in open court, which was obviously the correct response. And then they got back to the jury room, and when they looked at the written response that they got from the court actually said no, which was obviously problematic. And at that point in time, according to many jurors who have talked to Eric's lawyer since then and talked to the media since then, that was the point at which conversation in the deliberation room really shifted. Before that point in time, the jury was really split about whether or not Eric had been entrapped and whether or not they should convict him. But after that improper instruction was given by the judge, they decided that they had to convict him. So, and that, of course, is what ended up being a huge argument for Eric in the appeals process. Because, like I said, a number of jurors have identified that as a problem for them in the jury room. It was obviously an error on the court's part. You know, who knows if it was on purpose or not. I'm sure lots of people have ideas about that one way or the other. But, you know, the bottom line is it happened, and it was the wrong instruction. So a lot of jurors have identified that as a problem. Also, coincidentally, a lot of jurors who talked to the media and also two jurors filed affidavits for Eric's sentencing saying that, you know, they thought the FBI had really overstepped their boundaries, that Anna was out of control, that she seemed like she didn't know what she was doing, that she was pushy. And so clearly, you know, even the jurors who ultimately voted to convict Eric felt like there were huge problems with this case. And like I said, the two folks who filed the affidavits actually said in those affidavits that they believe he should at the very least be given a new trial. So, you know, there are lots of problems with Eric's case.
What stage of the appeals process is Eric in?
Well, unfortunately, we're kind of at the end of the appeals process. His His appeal, original appeal, was filed in September of 2009, and oral arguments were heard at the Ninth Circuit about a year later in August of 2010. The main points raised on appeal were, of course, that whole issue of the written response being different than the oral response. He also talked about errors in the entrapment instructions around the whole definition of predisposition. And then also we raised issues about the sentencing. At oral arguments, everyone, I think, really believed that, except for maybe those of us who had sort of sat through all of these other hearings and seen how things actually go, but almost everybody who sat through the oral arguments at the Ninth Circuit really believed that the court was going to vote in Eric's favor. The prosecutor definitely seemed to be in the hot seat, and the court seemed pretty convinced of at least a couple of Eric's lawyer's main arguments. But about a month after oral arguments happened, the court came back and denied every single one of Eric's points on appeal. Again, this was not really a surprise to those of us who had watched this whole mess unfold for the past, at that point, 4-plus years. The court had repeatedly ruled in favor of the government, even when their arguments didn't really seem to have any legal leg to stand on. And I think, the thing that points to is the fact that this case was never really about whether or not some law had been broken. It has always been about the government's targeting of radical environmentalists and anarchists, or at least people that they identify as such, and really about making an example out of Eric. And one other interesting thing about the appeals at the Ninth Circuit was the makeup of the panel who heard Eric's case. So there are three judges on each panel, and they're supposedly chosen at random. Two of the judges on Eric's panel were Bush Jr. nominees. One of the three had been described by various people as a legal conservative. And I think most alarming of all was this article that we dredged up on Consuelo Callahan, who was one of the judges on the panel. And the article indicated that she and Judge Morrison England, who was the trial judge in Eric's case, were buddies. And this was later confirmed by a lawyer who works in the Sacramento Federal Courts. So just in case the significance of that isn't clear, one of the judges who was deciding Eric's appeal, which would of course mean, or could mean, reversing the decisions of the lower court, was friends with the very person who made those rulings to begin with. So obviously, for a judge, having your decisions reversed is pretty much the worst kind of embarrassment. And, nobody actually knows what happens behind closed doors, but what we do know is that the written decision in Eric's appeal really reflected nothing that had taken place during the oral arguments and, seemed to be written before the oral arguments had even occurred. So after the denial at the Ninth Circuit, we filed a petition for a rehearing in bank, which is basically another thing that you file with the Ninth Circuit, saying that you think they made a mistake and sort of asking the larger Ninth Circuit, all the members of the court, to look at it again. That was denied in December of last year. So really that was the final thing that we could do on the Ninth Circuit level. The only thing left at this point is to file with the Supreme Court, which we have done. We filed a cert petition with the Supreme Court in April. But, I think it's pretty important for folks to understand that there's really a slim to none chance of that even going anywhere. The Supreme Court hears, 1% or less of all the cases that are filed with them. And also, we have to think about the makeup of the Supreme Court at this time. It's a very conservative court. And honestly, I think a lot of folks are afraid that if Eric's case did get heard at that level, that it would actually just serve to make the law worse for folks who are similarly situated in the future. And so at this point, I think we've really decided, and Eric has known this for a long time, that it's really time to focus on the long term and settle into the fact that Eric's going to be in prison for a long time. And we really need to focus on that and figure out how to build a support campaign for him that can, be sustainable for the long haul.
You mentioned that they made an example out of Eric. Is his sentencing proportional to other conspiracy cases?
You know, his sentencing is definitely not proportional to folks who have been accused of similar crimes. I don't know of too many conspiracy cases that are exactly like his as far as, you know, being targeted because of their politics, specifically for environmental actions or folks who, you know, have been identified as anarchists. What we do know is that folks, you know, especially if you look at all the Operation Backfire cases that happened in the Northwest a few years ago, you know, I think the most any of those folks got was about 13 years. And, you know, all of those folks actually, and I'm not saying that I agree with these sentences or that any of these folks should be in prison, but what we do know is that, you know, all of those folks actually get convicted of carrying out multiple actions over a number of years. And Eric, who never carried out any actions at all, you know, got a much larger sentence than any of those folks. And then, you know, we can also look to the sentences of his co-defendants who took plea agreements and got, you know, time served. So they basically never spent a day in jail after they got out on bail. The only person we know of at this point who has received a similar sentence is Marie Mason. And her sentence is actually a little bit longer than Eric's. And she was sentenced after Eric. My understanding and from reading the transcripts of her sentencing is that Eric's case was actually brought up and used as a reference by the government in her sentencing to make her sentencing as long as it was. So again, you know, it seems as if, unfortunately, the Eric's case has sort of been used as a model them, not only in the prosecution and creation of these cases, but also in how they're going to start sentencing people.
So Eric's been in prison for over 5 years now. What has Sacramento Prisoner Support been doing all this time?
Oh, so, you know, a lot of our work at the beginning, pre-trial, was really focused on getting his needs met in Sac County. You know, county jails are sort of notorious for having much harsher conditions in a lot of ways than federal facilities. For example, one of the things that we had to work really hard on was getting vegan food for Eric. They weren't supplying that to him in Sac County, and, you know, ultimately he ended up going on two separate hunger strikes to get that. And while that was happening, you know, we were getting folks to call the jail. We had a press conference outside of the jail, just really putting a lot of pressure on them to make that happen. We also did a lot of legal support for him. We helped his lawyer pre-trial and during trial as well. You know, a lot of fundraising, obviously, for legal fees. And I think one thing that folks in Sac Prisoner Support did from the get-go that was really crucial and important was just providing, like, really basic emotional support for Eric's family, you know, sort of helping them through the legal process, helping them understand what was happening and why it was happening and what was going to happen next. So I think all of those things really, you know, helped Eric's family, but also helped him because, you know, he knew that his family was being supported as well. Since his sentencing, he's been moved to a federal facility, and so a lot of our support since then has really focused on, you know, just making sure that people haven't forgotten about his case. You know, keeping the letters coming, keeping the books coming, and also trying to keep money in his support fund because that money goes towards things like helping me go visit him, for instance, which is a huge help for everybody. You know, those visits are really crucial for keeping his spirits and morale up. And so I really encourage people to go to his website. All the information is there about how to donate, how to write letters, and, you know, how to sort of keep supporting him through these years.
I read recently that there's a day of action being organized, June 11th. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, June 11th. So hopefully most people know, but June 11th was originally conceived as this International Day of Solidarity for Jeff Lures, who was sentenced on that day in 2001, to more than 22 years in prison for setting fire to three SUVs in Eugene, Oregon. And thankfully, in 2007, the Oregon Court of Appeals overturned that sentence, and it was later reduced to 10 years. So Jeff was released in December of 2009 after spending 9.5 years in prison. And, you know, unfortunately, since Jeff's arrest, a bunch of other folks have been indicted for similar actions, defense of the earth, and some of them have received sentences that are, you know, just as outrageous as Jeff's original sentence was. And obviously, the two folks who, like I said before, have received the longest sentences are Eric and Marie. So there are some folks in the Midwest who were really trying to think ahead about how to make this support, this long-term support for Eric and Marie, more sustainable. And one of the things that they came up with was sort of continuing this tradition of the June 11th Day of Solidarity. And so this will be the first year that it has really happened for Eric and Marie. We're really encouraging folks everywhere to organize events in their cities. We're going to do something here in Sacramento. Hopefully folks can organize stuff wherever they're at. And, you know, we really want this to be a day of solidarity for Eric and Marie, to sort of recognize the work that they have done and continue to do, but also to really build and strengthen the work that we're doing on the outside as well.
Awesome. So how can people contact you all and Eric?
So Eric has a website. It's supporteric.org. Our contact info is up on that site. And if folks are interested in June 11th, there's a website up for that as well. It's just June11.org. So you should be able to get everything you need from there. If you're hosting an event, let us know so we can put it up on the site. And we're excited to hear from everybody.
Awesome. Do you have anything else you'd like to say?
Yeah, I guess, you know, I just want people to remember that Eric's not really in jail for burning things down or breaking things, but just for believing in something. And, you know, he's in prison for 2 decades, not because he was convicted of something that carries some mandatory 20-year sentence, but because he refused to take a plea or to cooperate with the state. And he stood up for himself and stayed true to who he was through all of this. And, you know, frankly, I think that kind of scares the shit out of the state. If everybody acted with such integrity and resolve, we might live in a much different world. And I'm not saying that to lionize Eric or what he has done. I think, you know, he's really just one example among many. My point is that we are all capable of acting with integrity and fighting for the things we love. And, you know, now's the time.
Cool. Well, thank you.
Thank you so much for this opportunity. We appreciate it.